Welcome, welcome, welcome to Jerry Roach's podcast. Continuing our tour through my book, Northern Heights, Climbing North America's Highest Peaks, we now turn to Chapter 4, Touching History, Mount Lucania, 1967. Topology lesson. After class, I found a seat in the University of California, Berkeley library, opened Kelly's General Topology, and tried to concentrate. I was having trouble with this text and braced myself. The text pontificated, "A homeomorphism or topological transformation is a continuous one-to-one map of a topological space X onto a topological space Y, such that f to the minus 1 is also continuous. If there exists a homeomorphism of one space onto another, the two spaces are said to be homeomorphic, and each is a homeomorph of the other." Oh boy, it was going to be a long study session. My graduate classes in math were stimulating but difficult. I spent all my time studying and had little patience for substandard textbooks, so I decided to look for other books on topology. Naturally, the topology of Alaska and Canada was a good place to start, so I followed my feet as they morphed me home to the mountaineering section. There was a complete set of American Alpine journals there, and I eagerly browsed through the old journals. This was my additional topological research and a study break that I occasionally allowed myself. Week by week, I was systematically studying the first ascents of the important peaks in Alaska and the Canadian Yukon. I found in this history a fascinating analysis of mountaineering motives and the sport's founding exploratory spirit. This was important research for my own Joy Becomes Peace project. The 18,008-foot mass of Mount St. Elias sits near the elbow in the Alaska-Yukon border, just a few miles from the Gulf of Alaska. Because of the peak's visibility from the ocean, it was the first high northern peak to be climbed. In a tour de force for the Times, the Duke of Abruzzi stood on top of St. Elias on July 31, 1897. From the summit, he looked north across the immense Seward Glacier and clearly saw the brooding massif of Mount Logan. Far to the northwest, the Duke also saw another peak that he called Mount Bona, named after his racing yacht back in Italy. His shrewd eye saw yet another high peak behind and left of Logan. This peak he named Mount Lucania, after the ocean liner that he had sailed in across the Atlantic on his way to St. Elias. The 1898 Klondike Gold Rush and the discovery that Denali was North America's highest peak soon overshadowed the Duke's remarkable climb, and for the next 15 years, mountaineering activity centered on the Great One. After years of controversy, false claims, and near misses, Archdeacon Stuck finally reached Denali's highest point in 1913. The ascent of a great peak is certainly a celebration of peace, since without peace we are not free to climb. Sadly, after Denali's golden age, World War I dramatically interrupted mountaineering. After the war, mountaineers turned their attention to 19,540-foot Mount Logan, Canada's highest peak, and North America's second highest peak. Logan, a massive mountain in the center of the St. Elias Range, is a sovereign among monarchs. More difficult to reach than Denali, early expeditions to Logan supplied the long approach by dog-sledding caches toward the mountain during the spring, and a determined team finally climbed Logan in 1925. The difficult approach to Logan was only a precursor of the trip's other trials, and Logan stretched the expedition members to their limit. The magnificent first ascent of Logan in 1925 sparked new interest in the great northern summits. And one by one, the summits felt climbers' boots. Bona was climbed in 1930, Fairweather in 1931, Foraker in 1934, and Steele in 1935. In 1937, Lucania was still unclimbed. At 17,257 feet, Lucania is North America's eighth highest peak and Canada's third highest peak. Nature has thrown up a mass of defenses around Lucania, and it was even more difficult to approach than Logan. In 1937, Lucania was not just unclimbed, it was the highest unclimbed peak in North America, and it had become a great prize. I plucked the 1938 American Alpine Journal from the shelf in January of 1967. On page 95 was Bradford Washburn's article titled, "The Ascent of Mount Lucania." The 20-page article intrigued me, so I settled into an ancient chair at the end of the aisle and began to read. Washburn made an aerial reconnaissance of Lucania in April 1935. Then, in the summer of 1935, an expedition that did not include Washburn climbed 16,470-foot Mount Steele. The climbers started at Burwash Landing on the Alaska Highway in the Yukon Territory, walked up the Steele Glacier, and climbed Steele by its east ridge. From the summit of Steele, they saw Lucania 7 miles to the southwest across a high plateau. The plateau in Lucania's upper slopes did not appear difficult, but it was not practical to carry supplies for Lucania over Steele's summit. Washburn knew that the key to Lucania was getting to the broad Lucania Steele Plateau, and that they could do this from either the Walsh Glacier on the south side of the peak or from the Chitna Glacier north of the peak. These two glaciers flow west from Lucania into Alaska and drain into the Chitna River, which passes the tiny outpost of McCarthy and the small town of Chitna before joining the larger Copper River. Washburn chose a south ridge leading from the head of the Walsh Glacier to the plateau. Washburn assembled a team of four, and in early May 1937, Bob Reeve flew most of the team's food and equipment from Valdez, Alaska, to 8,600 feet on the Walsh Glacier. Reeve had no problem landing and taking off from the glacier on these freight flights, but conditions on northern mountains change rapidly as spring progresses, and trouble lay ahead. On June 18, Reeve flew Washburn and Bob Bates to the Walsh Glacier, but when they landed, the plane immediately bogged down in a sea of slush 8 feet deep. The plane barely moved, even under full power, and had no chance of taking off. A vast wilderness had trapped the men. To make matters worse, warm torrential rains fell on the glacier and the plane sank deeper into the slush. The men worked patiently for days, but almost lost the plane completely in a crevasse. Fortunately, after 4 days, there was a light freeze that allowed Reeve to take off and return to Valdez. It was not possible for Reeve to return to the Walsh Glacier with the other two members of the expedition, so their trip was over. Meanwhile, Washburn and Bates sat on the glacier with a large pile of gear, wondering how they were going to get back to civilization. Suddenly, their goal was not climbing a mountain, but escaping from the wilderness. As Washburn and Bates looked west down the Walsh Glacier, they contemplated over 100 miles of desolation between them and the outpost at McCarthy, Alaska. Burwash Landing on the Alaska Highway was 70 miles to the northeast, but they had to cross Steele to escape in that direction. The two men carefully weighed their choices. The badly crevassed Walsh Glacier was in horrible condition, and they shrank from the thought of descending it, so they took a long exploratory hike up to the head of the Walsh to inspect the route up Steele. Washburn and Bates made their decision. They would climb to the Lucania Steele Plateau by the ridge that they had already picked out, escape over Steele Summit, and descend the East Ridge route pioneered 2 years earlier. At least that route had been traveled once before. They reasoned that if the 1935 party had climbed up Steele, they could get down it somehow. Their first chore after making their pivotal decision, was to eliminate most of their food and equipment, since they had to travel light if their upward escape was going to work. They prepared a huge cache of expensive cameras, food, tents, and clothes, protected it by wrapping it in a large tarp, and left it behind in case they had to retreat. They took one tent to live in, another tent with the floor ripped out to protect their advance caches, two sleeping bags, two air mattresses, limited clothing, one camera, 15 gallons of fuel, and 50 days of food. Their food was in two bags. One bag would get them to the plateau and the other the rest of the way to Burwash Landing. They agreed to leave the second bag untouched until they reached the plateau, no matter how long it took to get there. On June 25th, they had a sad parting with their expensive cache, then escaped upward. Lucania's great south face soared above them, watching their meager efforts. Their assault on Steele was grim business, since they knew from the start what they were up against. They joked that they were not trying to make a first ascent of Steele's South Ridge. They had to make a first ascent. They worked for several days to move their food and equipment to the base of the ridge, using their sledge for a few miles, then abandoning it when the glacier became too rough. It snowed hard most of the time, but every day had a few clear hours in which they sprinted ahead to mark their route with wands. Taking advantage of a sudden clearing on July 1, they climbed to 12,500 feet on their south ridge. The ridge was harder than expected, so after returning from this adventure, they knew that they had to go still lighter. Making another drastic cut in their equipment, they threw away one sleeping bag, one mattress, the second tent, a large part of their clothing, and half their fuel. As they committed to the ridge, Lucania's east face didn't just watch, but taunted them. The weather closed around them, but they struggled up through small lulls in the nearly continuous storm. The snow conditions were awful, so they adopted an inchworm tactic, moving their relays up short sections of the route, hoping that their trail did not snow over between carries. On July 6, in a complete whiteout, they reached 14,000 feet on the ridge edge of the plateau and became the first humans to walk on this elusive place. By noon on July 7, they had their last load on the plateau with them and became fugitives in the subtle splendor. As they cooked supper, the skies cleared and they saw Lucania's northern slopes for the first time. They had 30 days of food with them on the plateau. When they did make their break over Steele, they would push straight through with no more relays, since there was no way they could carry everything over Steele. Thus, they planned to abandon 12 excess days of food on the plateau, which meant that they had 12 days to climb Lucania. Washburn and Bates were not going to let Lucania taunt them any longer. That evening, as mists swirled around them, they moved a load 3 miles closer to Lucania across the plateau's soft, flat snows. The next day, the weather closed in hard and forced them to sit in camp all day. Their collective experience with Alaskan weather was extensive, and they discussed the prospects for summit weather. On previous expeditions, they had always seen at least 3 clear days, sometime between July 4 and July 25. They waited. They did not have to wait long, since the skies cleared late that afternoon. The pair pushed off after a hurried supper, then the weather cleared in earnest, the temperature dropped, a fair breeze blew, and a glorious sea of silver clouds rolled gently in the valleys below. At 10 p.m., they pitched camp on the western end of the plateau under the final 3,600-foot slope leading to Lucania's summit. They had lost elevation from their previous camp, but were many miles closer. They turned in at midnight. July 9 dawned cloudless. They brewed themselves a luxurious breakfast of prunes, cornmeal mush, bacon, and coffee. Washburn and Bates set off for the evasive summit at 9 a.m. and immediately foundered in deep snow. They plowed up for hours on their snowshoes. Then, when it got too steep, they switched to crampons, but promptly sank up to their waists. They almost gave up, but still wanted to see the view of Logan from the ridge, so they pressed on for this consolation prize. It took them over an hour to plow a deep trench up the last 200 feet to the ridge. From the vantage, the view of Logan inspired them so much that they had to climb on. Lucania's summit was only a mile away, and their resolve stiffened as they munched raisins, dates, and cheese. Setting a slow, careful pace, they reached the summit at 4:30 p.m. Clear views of all the great peaks in the St. Elias Range deeply moved Washburn and Bates, and for a few precious minutes their minds flew free. Their night descent was like a dream, but their ensuing retreat turned their dream into a nightmare. Back at their plateau cache, they eliminated yet more food and equipment. They cached most of the kitchen gear, all their extra clothes, all but 1 gallon of gas, and cut most of the floor out of the remaining tent. Stripped to essentials, they went up and over Steele's summit, making the second ascent of that peak. The half hour they spent on Steele's summit deeply etched itself in their memories. Their uphill fight was over. They plowed down Steele's east ridge through horrendous snowdrifts. With no other choice, they just kept going, and the lower they got, the more equipment they threw away. By the time they reached the Steele Glacier, they had eliminated the rest of the tent floor, the tent pegs and guy lines, the remaining air mattress, their crampons, ice axes, and snowshoes. Now, all they had to do was walk 50 miles northeast to the Alaska Highway. For the next 2 days, they struggled with tottering moraines, swollen torrents, and packs that still seemed to grow constantly heavier. When they finally got off the Steele Glacier, they faced an even worse adversary, the Donjek River, which they had to cross to reach Burwash Landing. Unable to find a place to cross, they resigned themselves to walking upstream away from their destination to find a ford. They made a last despondent cut of their supplies that included the tent pole, then walked upstream for 20 miles. That night they gave up in despair and camped on a mud bank swathed in their poleless, floorless tent. In the morning, with no other choice, the petrified pair got across the cold river near the snout of the Donjek Glacier. They made it to Burwash Landing 5 days later on July 19. Lucania reduced Washburn and Bates to two pitiful, aching shadows of the proud mountaineers that had landed on the Walsh Glacier a month earlier, but they were alive and would recover from their ordeal. Somehow, in spite of horrendous problems, Washburn and Bates pulled off the first ascent of Lucania during a desperate escape from the wilderness. My brain exploded. Wow! They don't make mountaineers like they used to, I mused, as my foot tapped nervously against the creaky chair. The librarian's shrill voice startled me. Closing time! Closing time! I glanced at my watch. It was late, and today's topology lesson was over, so I hustled out of the library. As I slipped my bike through the traffic on Berkeley's famous Telegraph Avenue, I was already planning my expedition to Lucania. Birth of an Expedition. How does a graduate student in math plan an expedition to the far reaches of the Yukon? The next day, I raced back to the library and searched through all the journals to see if anyone else had gone to Lucania. Amazingly, no one had climbed or even attempted Lucania since 1937. In a strange turning of the history wheel, Lucania was now the highest peak in North America that had not had a second ascent. Next, I wrote Bradford Washburn, and he took an immediate interest in my proposed Lucania expedition. I peppered him with questions, and he peppered me with advice, encouragement, and most important of all, his excellent aerial photographs of Lucania and Steele. He also confirmed that no one had been to Lucania since his 1937 trip. Devouring the aerial photographs, I lay them out with maps of the area and carefully studied every inch with a magnifying glass, letting the topography and adventure come alive in my mind. There is an easy north ridge leading up to the Lucania Steel Plateau from the Chitna Glacier, and this ridge looked like fun, but so did Lucania's complex west side. My careful study of the photos revealed a possible route up the west ridge, which looked much more difficult than the north ridge, but we could also approach the west ridge from the Chitna Glacier. The west ridge would be a more technical prize, while the north ridge would allow us to climb both Lucania and Steel. I resolved to approach the peak from the Chitna Glacier and make a final route determination later. No climbing team had ever been on the Chitna Glacier, and I realized that I was on to something special. Next, I wrote my friend and glacier pilot Jack Wilson. I had flown with Wilson during the summer of 1964 when I worked on top of Mount Wrangell building a high-altitude research hut. Wilson remembered my penchant for ice cream, since on that expedition he flew over our Wrangell summit hut once a week and dropped 2 half-gallons. One was for me and the other was for everybody else. Wilson, like Don Sheldon of Denali fame, was an excellent glacier pilot. Wilson had flown all over the St. Elias Range and knew the complicated range well. Because Wilson lacked Sheldon's charisma and operated far from Denali, he did not get Sheldon's notoriety. But Wilson, like me, was not in business for attention, so we got along great. Wilson was not a climber, but he loved and respected the mountains he flew past. He was always interested in whether a climber's route would go or not. He wrote back and agreed to land us on the Chitna. He thought the North Ridge would go, but wasn't sure about the West Ridge. Studying the maps and photos of a place where no one had ever been, then securing a means of getting there, made me realize that I had accessibility. Dreams alone will not guarantee the summit. You also have to be able to get to the bottom of the mountain. Now, all I needed was a team. Through a mutual friend in Berkeley, I contacted Jerry Halpern at Stanford. Halpern was on Ad Carter's 4-acre trip in 1963, and it was their radio that saved us from walking out after my Denali climb. I did not meet Halpern on the Kahiltna because he was high on 4-acre, but when I called, he immediately invited me to the next meeting of the Stanford Alpine Club. 2 minutes after meeting Halpern, I slipped the Lucania photos under his nose. The sheen of a Washburn photo was a magnet, and a crowd quickly gathered. The eclectic nature of my Lucania trip attracted the Stanford intellectuals. Halpern was finishing an advanced degree in statistics, and he already had a good job with one of the Bay Area's hospitals. Thus, he was proving that there is some practical application for mathematics, and we had a penetrating discussion on this subject. Gary Lucas was finishing a pre-med curriculum and was already well studied in medicine. Mike Humphreys was a literature major. Halpern, Gary, and Mike joined the adventure on the spot, and by the end of the evening we had an academic expedition. After my school term ended in early June, Mike and I drove an old VW Bug from Berkeley to Glen Allen, Alaska in 3.5 exhausting days. The starter was broken, and we had to push-start the Bug every time, so we were careful where we parked. Halpern and Gary were a day behind in Halpern's VW Bug, but when they didn't show up after 3 days, Mike and I knew that something had gone wrong. They finally pulled in with a dented Bug and a tale of woe. The Army built the Alaska Highway during World War II, and deliberately created continuous curves in the road so that the enemy couldn't strafe military convoys. The Alaska Highway had 1,200 miles of dirt road in 1967, and one of the worst problems was passing trucks that threw up a road-consuming dust plume. You either dropped back and followed the truck for the next 100 miles, or got impatient and tried to pass the truck blind. The usually imperious Halpern got impatient and went for a big one. He lost it, the Bug rolled into a ditch, and the truck rumbled on, oblivious to the problem. Fortunately, the accident did not seriously hurt Halpern or Gary, and they were able to repair the car. Our expedition nearly ended in a highway ditch, and I still consider driving more dangerous than climbing. While waiting for Wilson on June 19, we assembled our pile of gear on the Chitna airstrip, after which I began my nervous pacing. Again, I paced at the edge of a great wilderness and a great adventure. I felt like an insatiable satyr creeping toward the great peaks. I had been almost desperate to get deep into the St. Elias Range since 1964, when I worked on top of Wrangell. From Wrangell, I had seen Blackburn and Bona. They were spectacular peaks, but I knew that the great summits of Lucania, Logan, and St. Elias lay hidden beyond. Even from the top of a 14,000-foot peak, I had not seen into the heart of this vast, reclusive range. The St. Elias Range is one of the wildest places on the planet, and is certainly North America's crowning glory. The peaks are a little lower than Denali, but there are a lot more of them. The St. Elias Range is much larger than the Alaska Range, and is more heavily glaciated since it is closer to the coast and the storms. From Denali's summit, we saw tundra, but Logan is surrounded by ice. It is a colder, stormier range in a vast international wilderness. Those who feel the siren call need no further explanation. However, while they are packing to answer the call, others ask, why? It is hard work, it is dangerous, it is cold, it is expensive. Why go? Turn it around for once. Why work so hard to fix that little bug in your computer program? Surely it's too much work and too expensive to solve. Kick back, head for the beach, take mind-dulling drugs, and assume the fetal position. Then a plane flies into a mountain because of the bug in your program. Anyone can sit on a beach. It takes a stronger life force to fix the bug. It takes a stronger life force to climb the mountain. It is the same thing. Fix the bug, prove the theorem, win the ball game, get the contract, get the promotion, get rich, get laid. Everybody is climbing a mountain. Everybody has a dream. Mountaineering just distills human activity to its essentials. It makes life clear. It is life itself. If you are alive, you have to move your body through three dimensions. Stripped to fundamentals, climbing a great peak is no different than getting out of bed in the morning. The ascent of a great peak is also a monument to peace and freedom. It is a celebration of life. The four of us were packing to go. Wilson appeared from some concealed farness, landed in a cloud of dust, exchanged pleasantries, quickly loaded our gear, and flew us 50 miles east up the Chitna River Valley to the tiny settlement of May Creek. This operation was not as straightforward as flying into Denali, and Wilson broke it into two pieces. Since Lucania was still 100 miles east of May Creek, across the border in the Yukon Territory, while Sheldon could stand by his hangar and assess the weather on Denali, Wilson had no way of knowing what the weather was like 100 miles away in the heart of the St. Elias Range. Ours was an intuitive operation. While we stood around in May Creek swatting mosquitoes, Wilson said, "Well, Jerry, throw some of this stuff in the plane. Let's head up there and check it out." We took off, then slowly climbed east toward the great hidden peaks. Stay tuned for part 2 of this grand adventure to Mount Lucania in 1967.